This week, it's business at the front, party in the back. We speak to the editor of one of Britain's leading weekend newspapers about how to strike a balance between out-of-hours fun and business as usual. Plus, Monocle's Finest pick some of their favourites from the newsstand, and a car magazine happy to go off-road. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. The weekend edition of the Financial Times has a discerning readership who expect the same assiduous reporting and astute opinion leading that they get from its weekday cousin, but also want to wind down, perusing its Life and Arts, House and Home and FT magazine sections. A few weeks ago, we spoke to the editor of the magazine, Alice Fishburne. This week, we had the pleasure of welcoming Alec Russell, the editor of the paper, to our Midori House studios. Here's Alec speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Alec, a pleasure to have you here at Monocle 24 again on The Stack. Alec, my first question before we talk about the FT Weekend in particular, how do you see the future of weekend papers compared to the daily ones?
I think that the future of weekend papers is rather different to the future of daily newspapers. Everyone, whether journalists or just readers of newspapers, have been acutely aware in the last 5+ years that daily papers have been losing readers and losing advertisers because of the digital revolution. It's just in front of all of us. I mean, I see it every morning on the tube. When I came back from years as a foreign correspondent 10 years ago to take up an editing post at the FT, loads of people on the tube are reading their papers. Now, of course, everyone's reading their smartphone. It's different at the weekend. I think that's one of the really interesting realizations we've had at the FT in the last year or so, is that there can be two very different narratives for print. And so while there is unquestionably we're in an age of print declinism overall, I think it's completely different at the weekend, that people of all ages, not just older readers, still want to sit back with a newspaper at the weekend. And so we have to have a different strategy to the weekend to the strategy of the week.
And do you think this is related? Because, you know, when you read the FT Weekend, it is a beautiful product. You know, it's not only about the paper, you have wonderful supplements of how to spend it. It's about beauty in some ways as well, don't you think?
Fernando, you've got a job tomorrow. You can come. That's it. You're hired. We like you. We like fans. More seriously, thank you. I do think quality matters more than ever now. I mean, one would like to think and hope that quality has always mattered in as much as people pay for it. And if you go into journalism, you want to do great stuff. But now, in an age of plunging budgets and disappearing titles, if you can stand out in the crowd through your classiness, then people will go on paying for you. People are prepared to pay for print if they think it's good, original, well-written, well-presented journalism. So yes, the editing, the design matter to us hugely. And I have to tell this to my staff at the FT Weekend, that yes, we are pursuing the digital revolution enthusiastically, coming up with new ways of telling stories, trying to increase our readership online via, you know, video, animations, etc., etc. But if we start cutting corners in print, if we start saying it doesn't really matter how the pages look, doesn't matter if there's the odd typo, then it's a disaster. It has to be unimpeachably classy and has to look good, as you say. And I mean, How to Spend It's in a sort of, you know, feel of its own.
It's a great magazine. But also we need to talk about, you know, you're branching out a bit your business strategy. So, for example, just, you know, a few weeks ago, you know, it was the FT Weekend Festival. Tell us how this is contributing to the brand as well.
Okay, well, yes, the festival, we had our second FT Weekend Festival 2 weeks ago. In North London, beautiful garden in Hampstead, Kenwood House. We had 2,500 to 3,000 people. Between 2,000 and 2,000 had paid, well, something like £80 a ticket. Maybe some have paid a little bit less, but that was the standard ticket price. Lots of tents, 8 different tents, full of people talking about ideas and panels, and broadly reflecting the different arms of the weekend FT. There was an art stage, a book stage, how to spend it stage, a main idea stage, etc. All good fun. So point number one, it was a wonderful way of communicating with our readers, listening to them, meeting them. So yes, it was good for the brand, good for marketing. But I also think that there is a commercial play here, namely, look at the music industry. An old friend of mine at The Economist was reflecting to me recently about the FT Weekend Festival, and he said, yes, you know, we have to remember how the music industry's gone, and they haven't given up on the album, namely the printed edition, but increasingly it's the big live events that are the kind of the really key things. And I think that live events are very important to us. Now, one caveat for all the enthusiasm of the FT Weekend editor about what was a really fun, buzzy event. At the moment, the real money in events is via the business-to-business events. It's the sort of core, for us, you know, the core accountants conference in wherever it is, the capital of accounting. Boom. That's more profitable for us than getting 2,500 FT Weekend fans to come to a glorious day in Kenwood House, because it's expensive to put on a classy event. Hiring the grounds at Kenwood House, putting up the magnificent marquees, etc., is more expensive than hiring some big conference hall in the centre of London. But it's a huge part of our future, unquestionably.
Well, glad to hear. And, you know, talking about, for example, some of the people that went to the festival, are they FT Weekend readers, or they are perhaps also the readers of the daily FT?
Mainly FT Weekend readers.
Is there a big difference between them? Do you see, or do you think, you know, the readers of the daily, you know, go and buy the paper in the weekend as well for a different outlook in the world?
There is a difference. There's a huge difference, actually. And it's a difference that we're trying to blur, in as much as we think that there are FT... We think that there should be a lot of readers during the week who don't read us at the weekend at the moment who would like us. And one of the reasons that we think that they're not reading us at the weekend is that they're not aware that the FT weekend is rather different from the FT during the week. So I think broadly you could say that quite a lot of our readers during the week read us because they know they have to, or think they have to. There's going to be the crucial information about the movements in the currency markets, the Chinese regulation on Bitcoin, whatever it is. They feel they need to know what's happening in global finance, economics, business, politics, etc. But at the weekend, they're thinking, gosh, I just want a break. The FT weekend, as you know, as a reader, is very different from the FT during the week. Yes, we do the core news stories and so on. But frankly, the heart of the FT weekend is about life. It's about ideas. It's about art. It's about books. It's about style. So we are trying to alert our weekday readers more to what we have at the weekend. But equally, maybe it's just, you know, we just have to accept that broadly they're slightly separate readerships, and that's fine. Both can be expanded. We can do our best to cross-pollinate, and we're doing more of that. But yes, they're different tribes.
And Alec, if you don't mind giving us a little preview of some of the stories on this weekend's paper.
Well, highlight is the magazine cover story about Ivanka Trump, which is based on a series of interviews with her and lots of conversations with people who know her well. It's been a difficult story to write because it's the nature of dealing with any White House, any administration, that they're incredibly controlling and very hard to get genuine access to the sort of key figures there. But I think that's the big highlight.
Fantastic. And Alec, we ask our guests here on the Stack, which other papers or magazine styles, I mean, do you like to read? Maybe perhaps for inspiration or just because you're a fan?
In print, I read during the week, I read the FT and the London Times, which arrives on my doorstep. So I read print at breakfast, then sort of clumping along on the tube, I read online. I have a look at the Wall Street Journal, I have a look at the New York Times. Then I sort of switch again when I get into the office. Well, there's not much time to read in the office, if any. I'm afraid it's going to sound terribly inevitable. I do love The New Yorker. It is amazing. I read The Economist when I can. Sunday papers, I graze. There was an era when the Sunday papers were indispensable. I just don't think that's the case now.
Alec Russell there, editor of the Financial Times Weekend. of the advantages of producing a show about magazines out of the office of a magazine is that we're surrounded by people as excited about print as we are on the stack. And there are a few more knowledgeable and enthusiastic than Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, who this week kindly agreed to run through some of his favourite titles currently on newsstands. He was joined by Monocle's director of photography, Matt Beeman. Here he is speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Rich and Matt, a pleasure to welcome here on the stack. We have a couple of nice titles here. We're going to focus more on the biannual titles. The first thing I notice, starting with you, Matt, the size. I mean, Pop, it's more than 700 pages.
Yeah.
And who says print is dead?
Yeah, I mean, carrying them downstairs here, that's just saying it's kind of probably way over 1,000 pages, the three of them combined. It's impressive.
Rich, what does that say about the market we work for, the publishing market?
Well, I think it's interesting. Here we've got three hefty tomes, you know, 700 pages, 500 pages, and 500 pages. That's Pop, Love, and Purple. Purple being its 25th anniversary issue, so, you know, you'd expect them to pack a lot in. An absolute ton of advertising. But quite interesting, they all have a slightly different approach to fashion. One's earring on the more artistic, we sort of believe. Others are more commercial. But it's as magazines, when you have 700 pages, they're quite difficult things to navigate. They're a kind of bridging, I suppose, between a photography book or an art book and a fashion magazine. And I'm not sure if they're how successful they really are. I don't mean commercially. I mean in terms of sometimes these things can feel a little bit like stream of consciousness. It's just an endless, endless gallery of images. Some, I think, the pacing is better than others. Interesting, we've got Matt here because, you know, coming from a commissioning side of things, we can ask him, how much freedom do you give a photographer? How many pages do you allocate to something? Because some of these things, I don't know, the approach is a little bit of on the indulgent side of things. Mm.
That's a good question, especially in a magazine like Purple. You do see the work of some photographers like Jürgen Teller, you know, doing crazy things that apparently they just say, oh, okay, Jürgen, you can do whatever you want now and give us 30 pages of it.
And he does seem to have kind of free reign with Purple to do whatever he wants, which is interesting and brave of them to be able to do that. But they still managed to attract a lot of big brand advertising and you know, they seem to enjoy being in the magazine next to some of Jürgen's shoes. And the same with Wolfgang Tillmans in this issue. It's quite a kind of raw shoot, but it's amazing they have the freedom to do that.
Let's focus a little bit on Purple. I know you were the first one in the office to have a copy, actually. I struggled to find my copy, but tell us a bit more. It's a special edition as well. I believe there are 25 issues. Or?
25th anniversary, yeah. 25 covers. Just an amazing array of photographers who shot these covers. There's Terry Richardson, Jürgen Teller, Inez and Vanude. There's a Richard Prince cover, Cindy Sherman. And it's an impressive feat.
Are you a fan, Rich, of Purple?
Sometimes, yeah. I liked it a few years ago. I've not picked up the last couple of copies. I often find with these big issues, these big biannuals, that I don't need that many of them. I mean, I sort of collect five and then I feel like I've got enough. You know, they're always epic and worth, you know, keeping hold of. And I think this 25th anniversary issue, I think Matt and I were discussing whether it's worth buying. I think it may be worth money in the future. But I think the thing I slightly struggle with is I don't quite know where one story starts and the other one ends. And I think when I have a look at something like Love magazine, which asked us to get in so we could compare, and Matt and I have been comparing this morning, is that I think Love, although I'm not the biggest Love magazine fan, it feels so much more polished and art-directed and structured to me. And, of course, those things appeal to my nature of being, you know, a magazine designer. And it feels very, very, you know, commercial-minded, especially in comparison to the Jürgen Teller work, which we've just, you know, just been talking about. Yeah, there's pros and cons, and I suppose I'm not sure how to take them sometimes. I think sometimes these things we've given, and let's be frank about it, Jürgen Teller's an artist, I think, in the sense of Purple magazine, and he's given complete free rein, but I'm not sure how much context there is for the reader. And so I think if you're going to buy a fashion magazine, which ultimately Purple is, I think sometimes these things need a little bit more context, which I think you might get more in Love magazine.
I agree. And one thing I want to discuss with you, Matt, as well, the fact, one thing I've noticed, they're quite smart, of course, they're biannuals, just they come only twice a year. they seem to be, have this trend that to have several covers. I know Purple has a specific 25 covers because, you know, it's a special edition.
Yeah.
But even Love and Pop as well, they come out with
more
10.
More and more.
I think they want to be like a collectible, as Rich was saying. You know, it might be worth money in the future.
I think that's it. And probably Arena On Plus started that kind of trend, really. That multiple cover issue. Yeah. But it seems to be the kind of norm. Yeah, it's happening a lot.
It does give me a lot of stress because especially if you're a fan of magazine, you want to have all of that, you know.
Yeah, well, that's...
There is a weird feeling with it sometimes.
Well, I'm not sure what the theory is. I mean, I should think there's a commercial line of thought behind it, but it's certainly more expensive. You have to print more than one cover costs double the amount. And then there's logistics of packing them. If you've got 25 covers, you want to have a spread that goes to each shop. And you're right, Pop has several covers often. Love has several covers often. A magazine called French does 10 or more covers each time. And I don't know whether they're playing on the fact that they put multiple celebrities on and they're hoping to cash in on different followings, or whether people are super fans and they buy more than one issue. But I don't know whether you'd buy 5 copies of the same magazine.
Yeah, or 25 copies of Purple. I mean,
yeah,
maybe.
I remember that because Love, I think they did a special edition. I mean, it was not one of their biennials, but Madonna was on the cover. They did a major thing that you had to go to specific shops to buy, and there was like a queue to it. So, you know, there's this kind of appeal as well for some fans, I believe.
Yeah.
It's a strange one. Let's speculate here a little bit. Who do you think are the readers of those biennials? Do you think the typical person that buys the monthlies, Vogue, GQ, or whatever, would buy that, or this one is quite a specific type of person?
I'm not sure. I've always sort of wondered that myself. I should think it's a combination of students. I should think it's quite a young readership, fashion students, of course. And then I think there'll be people that work in the industry that will just feel they have to buy it, even if they don't necessarily want it, keep it. They'll want to find out who's shooting what. People in advertising will want to know, because it's got all the latest ad campaigns. In fact, the same ad campaigns are in all 3 magazines. As I think they'll be looking at it. I think hairstylists, fashion designers, art directors, which actually probably adds up to quite a lot of people, they will probably be buying it for professional interest. So I think, yeah, kind of a wide pool from those groups, I would have thought.
Guys, let's discuss Pop. Matt, what's your views on
like we've already kind of touched on it, I felt that, like Rich was saying, it does feel sometimes like a real stream of consciousness, and there's not much to break up each shoot. I mean, there's one shoot in here which is maybe 20 pages long, and it's, yeah, it does feel quite indulgent, I think, at times.
It's very, yeah, slightly repetitive at times. I mean, I don't want to be down on print and magazines, because they are gorgeous, glossy things. It's just, I think, when you start to analyse, it's, you know, how do you kind of navigate through 700 pages? And in the end, you know, you can go through, like, 40 pages and not find a page number. Or I think contents pages almost become irrelevant when you've got to find page 571, you know, out of 740.
Because there are some really beautiful things amongst and some really interesting things, but it's quite, yeah, as you say, it's quite hard to navigate.
And Pop changed a lot, I think, you know, after Cathy Grant left. You know, she gave this kind of more, well, Pop aesthetic to Love magazine in some ways. I think Pop became too arty sometimes. I don't know what you guys think.
Yeah, yeah. It's somewhere between Purple and Love, I guess. It's kind of gone more towards Purple, perhaps. But
it's interestingly in Purple, which I think is quite well structured, actually, just in terms of navigation. Like, each of the stories has a similar typographic headline. They've made a font out of what looks like cut up a piece of masking tape or something. So that every time you spot one of those, you know you're into a new story. You know there's a new photographer, a new model, a new stylist. So that the pace is quite intact there. There's a statement inside Purple, actually, that says that when it started 25 years ago, it was always intended to be an anti-fashion magazine. It was meant to be a fashion and art as fashion magazine. I mean, it seems like a bit of a swipe, actually, at the likes of Love. It says brands today seem to think they can get away without advertising in magazines, or they don't need fashion magazines because they can send their product to a celebrity who will put it on their Instagram account, and that will monetize the sale of their product. And then, of course, you've got Love magazine, which has, I would say, 50% celebrities to 50% models putting their clothes on celebrities and getting onto their Instagram accounts, and then doing, you know, at Christmas they do their Love Advent calendar, which features 30-odd celebrities and models. So they're doing the absolute, they're the antithesis, I think, of what Purple have said they, what, how they set out to be. So interesting. They've got two different approaches. They're using the same sort of high-end pool of fashion photographers and stylists and makeup crews. They've got the same advertising in them. Mm. And I think they're chasing the same readership, and yet they have kind of opposite ideals, I think, which is, yeah, it's an unusual that the kind of outcomes are sat on the same part of the newsstand.
Mm. Finally, a question for both of you. I mean, it doesn't necessarily need to be one of those three magazines, but which biennial do you think works, you know, has a very good combination, or, you know, perhaps is not 700 pages, but, you know, it does the job well for a biennial?
It's tricky.
Tricky question.
I was trying to
I'm going to go first just because I'm going to get my answer in before Matt does. And also because I saw it this morning, probably Gentlewoman still is doing a very good job of that. I know lots of women that really like that magazine. I think they pick their cover style very well. They seem to get kind of the zeitgeist correct. And I don't think they're trying to reinvent too often. And I think the articles, there's a lot to read in there. And I think from what I've understood from female friends and colleagues, it's always well received.
That's good. Yeah. Shout out to Penny, our regular.
Well, they're doing a good job, so yeah. Credit where credit's due, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I'd probably agree, actually, and that's pretty boring, but it's you know, it's beautifully designed, it's really accessible, and it's really nice to read.
Yeah, actually, it's a good word, accessible. When we when you're looking at 1,000 pages of fashion, it does feel very accessible, actually, and structured, and
whereas with Purple, it's quite hard to penetrate. And there's some really interesting things in that thing. There's a big essay by Richard Prince, and, you know, but it's quite hard to penetrate sometimes, I think. Yeah.
Guys, thank you so much.
Well, right. Great.
Thank you.
That was Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, and director of photography, Matt Beeman. Many of the magazines we feature on this show are either the products of established publishing houses or independents driven by the passion of a few brave souls. But increasingly, companies whose main business isn't print are putting out magazines. Their goal isn't just to promote their products explicitly, but to associate brands with a wider set of interests and lifestyles. One example is Cadillac, a publication made by the people behind America's most iconic automotive brand. There's plenty to keep the petrol heads happy, but 75% of the stories cover design, fashion, tech, culture and travel without a car in sight. On a recent visit to London, Cadillac's editor-in-chief Mark Ainsley popped into our studio to speak with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Mark, a pleasure to welcome you here at Midori House.
Thank you, Fernando.
On your, you know, short trip here to London. You're the editor-in-chief of Cadillac magazine. It's a very well-known car brand in the world. I think everybody wants to have a Cadillac. And there's also a magazine. Tell us about the beginnings of it. Did they get in touch with you?
Yeah, I think a lot of the major luxury car brands have magazines, and Cadillac wanted to do the same thing. The interesting thing about Cadillac compared to most of the other competitors was if you pick up a Porsche magazine, it's 100% Porsche in different ways. What's incredible about Cadillac, and one of the reasons I really love working there, is that it's 75% luxury lifestyle, 30%, 25% brand related. And even that brand related isn't simply car. It can be all the other aspects that Cadillac gets involved in, fashion shows, TV, films.
I was going to ask about that because, you know, I was reading the latest issue, and it is true. Of course, there are some mention of Cadillac, especially, you know, there's some specific stories. But overall, it could be like a normal lifestyle magazine. Do they put any pressure on you, or do they want that? They don't want to be only a magazine that talks about Cadillac, the brand.
Yeah, I think the thing is, you think about Cadillac, their Dare Greatly campaign, they're very bold, they're very innovative. So we try to cover that in the Cadillac stories themselves. But what we do with the lifestyle stories is they're implicit in the story. So when we do a story on Francis Mullman, he's a type of person that does Dare Greatly bold things. We don't have to mention it, but it's just there. So even though when you read the magazine, you don't get a great, you're not hit over the head with Cadillac, 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 the main core brand ideas are interlaced throughout the issue. One of the things that I've done and I'm really happy with is combining the Cadillac brand with the lifestyle seamlessly throughout the issue. So like you said, when you do read it, you get a sense of reading a luxury magazine. And here's some car stuff, here's some this stuff, here's some other stuff. But I didn't want it to be car, 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 lifestyle. I really wanted it to flow together.
What about the business model? Is this something that you personally have to consider, or the financial aspect of it is just on Cadillac's hands?
Right now it's on Cadillac's hands. Because the magazine right now is doing so well, it's growing incredibly. Things like the Japanese marketing group, for the first time, because what we're doing editorially on their own marketing expense, translated into Japanese. So these are new things. So with the quality going up, the more exposure, there's talk of, you know, more ads, there's talk of more exposure, there's talk of subscriptions to bring this around for more people.
It's funny that you mentioned the Japanese market because, you know, of course, it's an international brand. And, you know, we were talking before the interview that China is becoming a massive market for Cadillac. So you also have to kind of try to appeal to this new customer, you know, because the brand is changing, you know, the type of customer that buys a Cadillac, for example.
It's true. China's huge for Cadillac right now. Middle East is huge. Japan. And with that, as you'll see in the magazine, we're not U.S.-centric at all. We're a very global country, a coverage of things. We have Middle East, China stories, Japan, Mexico, Canada, all over. So it really is a global brand, and that's part of what's driving us to cover all that.
Tell us about the circulation numbers. They're super high. I find it fascinating.
Well, we're printing 300,000 copies, and again, these go to North America, Mexico, Canada, China, Middle East, and Japan.
And that's, in some ways, this proved that instead of just sending like a newsletter, you know, for a Cadillac fan, I think people still appreciate, you know, the power of print. And it's funny because, you know, Cadillac, you know, I see you have a lot of detail to photography as well. I think that's something very important in the magazine. What would you say about that?
The edit and all the photography is assigned. So another aspect that really makes this stand out is we're working with the same consumer writers that work at Monocle or Condé Nast Traveler or the New York Times, same photographers. So we're one of the few brands that still send writers and photographers around the world. So we recently had a writer in the Arctic Circle doing the 24-hour sun train ride. We sent someone to the Atacama Desert in Chile. I myself went to Mozambique for a story on some islands out there. Compared to a lot of regular consumer titles that are shrinking, we're growing, we have the budget, we have the reach, and it's something that people, top writers, top photographers really want to work with us. Plus, our paper stock is gorgeous, we print well, it's a really quality product.
Where can we find the magazine? I know that if you're a Cadillac owner, you have a subscription, but what about perhaps those that don't have a Cadillac?
Those should buy a Cadillac, first of all, then.
Yes.
You're insured the magazine. Beyond that, they're at every dealership. And soon on the website, you will be able to get subscriptions for it, I believe. We're working on that right now, and I will keep Fernando abreast of that.
Please do. When is the next issue coming out?
The next issue comes out in November. It's a very big and special issue.
I would like to see this one. And I want to tell you about the variety of stories. For example, I have the latest issue. You talk about, you know, eating insects, you know, getting lost in Kauai, Chile's Atacama Desert. It's very varied, you know, in some ways.
So one of the things as the editor that I've tried to do is create a list of stories that are not easily found online. Mm-hmm. We don't work off of press releases because we're twice a year. So it's a matter of searching for stories that our global curious reader will find interesting. You can find something about the Atacama Desert online, but you have to look for it. Here we're trying to present things that you're not going to find in other titles, forward-thinking stories, tech-driven, innovation-driven, entrepreneurial, but something that really is innovative, which takes care of the Cadillac brand, but again, in a soft power sell.
Mark, a quick question. I always ask our guests here on the Stack, what are your inspirations when you read magazines? Not necessarily inspirations, but which magazines do you like to sit down and read over the weekend?
Well, I'm a huge fan of the Financial Times, How to Spend It. New Yorker is incredible. I hate to sound say this because I'm here, but I do enjoy Monocle a great deal. Milk, the French home magazine, I'm also a huge fan of.
Oh, amazing. Well, Mark, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
That was Mark Einsler, editor-in-chief of Cadillac magazine, talking to Fernando. And that's it for this week's programme. Thanks to our producers Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Reese Sheridan, and our editors Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Comments or queries are welcome. As always, you can find Fernando at fp@monocle.com. Do pick up some of the print titles we've mentioned. Head to Monocle's very own newsstand, Kiosk Cafe, just around the corner from here at Paddington in London. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you for listening.